Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Vital Dissent. I'm your host, as always, Patrick McFarlane. This is episode 277. Show notes are at vitaldissent.com/277. And returning to the show, I'm very excited to be speaking today with Richard Cox. Richard, how's it going, man?
Okay, great. Great to be back on Vital Dissent. Thank you.
Yeah. And I've been looking forward to this conversation. Do you just want to remind the audience? I should put in the show notes page your first appearance. But do you want to remind the audience who you are and what you do?
Yeah, well, I in relevance to this, I podcast and write. So I have a kind of background distant from that in a kind of Eastern philosophy and spirituality. And at some point started applying some of the mindset and the philosophy I'd studied to geopolitical areas. I did a lot of work with Adam Fitzgerald on 9/11. And then into the more sort of philosophical elements around conspiracy theory and looking at geopolitics through that lens. That's kind of what I attempt to bring to the party. That's the Deep State Consciousness podcast.
Yeah, and so your website, your URL is it deepstateconsciousness.com then?
It is, yeah.
Okay. And so in with Adam, his show, The Darkened Hour, which I love that title. I love both your titles. They're great for both your shows. But today in this episode, we were talking about kind of a beloved figure in conspiracy, like old school conspiracy theorizing, Anthony Sutton. And then as it relates to conspiracies on a whole, because that kind of phenomenon is very popular, you know, just in the broader broader consciousness, but also particularly in the libertarianism realm. And then you're also working or you've actually released a book on COVID-19 as well. So we're going to talk about that towards the end. So just to kind of give a background, I mean, Anthony Sutton is a professor. He's someone in the Cold War years who wrote a lot of pieces about how, well, Wall Street has been on both sides of conflicts, including behind, you know, funding the Soviets. And then Nazi Germany as well, I believe, like the Bayer Pharmaceuticals, he was wrote pieces about that as well. And I actually have a copy of the book here, The Wall Street Trilogy by Anthony Sutton, which, you know, I have a whole bookshelf full of books that I haven't read or had time to read. But you did a couple podcast episodes that we're going to discuss just about Anthony Sutton and actually examining his pieces and finding some issues with it. So I'll just throw the floor to you then.
Well, yeah, to back up a bit, I did a kind of philosophical project on the nature of conspiracy theory and what is that line between sensible geopolitical analysis and more far out conspiracy theory. And coming out of that, I wanted to nail down how the world is a bit more. So I started a project on the history of empire in the 20th century and really went over the United States expansion overseas, into first Hawaii and then the Spanish-American War, the Philippines, and then the interventions into Central America. And that ultimately brought me up to the First World War. And I was interested to look at some of the more conspiratorial angles on that, particularly Perfidious Albion, the idea that the Perfidious Brits were actually secretly behind the whole thing as a way of neutering both Germany and Russia. And sometimes I thought the more alternative view asked really good questions. Sometimes I thought they could be dismissed. And I think my views came out substantially changed about the whole thing. That ultimately led up to Russian involvement and the Russian Revolution and the book that I think everyone knows about in these circles. Probably not that many people read. It's not an easy read. Sutton's Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. So I've been hearing these claims for 20 years about Wall Street secretly funding both sides. And it is the most fascinating and brilliant conspiracy theory, if you like, that whilst the United States is ostensibly anti-communist and does go around the world playing whack-a-mole with any left-leaning regime, occasionally, when it's a big fish like Russia or maybe China, they might do the opposite. They might give it the virus of communism to kneecap their economy and make sure they cannot be a competitor to them in the world. And that's kind of what played out, right? Because if Russia had become a more free market society in the early part of the 20th century, it would have been a much more viable competitor to US business and industry from then on. And communism, central planned economies didn't help with that. So it's an intensely compelling theory, at the center of which is Anthony Sutton. But I'm also struck by how it's the complete opposite way that basically any other historian has interpreted that period, where everyone else interprets it as a mad scramble by the British and the Americans to keep the Bolsheviks out and to keep the white Russians in power. These are the people they want to do business with. So I always find it fascinating when different people look at a particular issue and come away with radically different conclusions. I go, well, how can that be? So that's the starting point of my investigation into Sutton. And honestly, didn't know what I would find. It was a bit outside my wheelhouse to think that, or a bit outside the range of what I thought was possible to think that the US would be deliberately provoking communist revolutions. But I couldn't say, oh, it's not over the crazy line for me. Okay. If it would have been more, you know, the moon is made of cheese or something. So I was open to it.
And to me, you know, in listening to the episode that you sent me a couple episodes, because you did one about the Russian Revolution and then you circled back to Sutton specifically in a shorter episode. To me, I kind of connected the dots as Sutton maybe being a part of this. You know, if you read Justin Raimondo's Reclaiming the American Right, he traces the lineage of neoconservatism back to like figures like Burnham, you know, back kind of after, I think it's the interwar period, and then kind of after that, where they're actually like Trotskyists that break away from the, you know, the Soviet Union, or the Leninists more particularly. And then they come to the United States and they're so vehemently anti-Lenin that they kind of infect the American, like the old right movement, and bring it into the National Review kind of era. And to me, after listening to your second episode, I kind of got the impression that he was one of the court historians, or that in a sense he played a role where they would leak him false information, or, you know, insiders would give him false information and he would kind of run with it and present it to like more of the right wing John Bircher conspiracy culture, the anti-communist conspiracy culture.
That's what I ended up speculating. So just to back up slightly, there are really interesting things about Russia's involvement in the First World War in general. Like, I think the historian Sean McMeekin makes an excellent case that you could really post Russia as the primary instigator of their war, because of the mobilization is effectively war, and their mobilization was the thing that forced Germany to mobilize and roll out the plan of invading France and then going to knock the Russians out. So, and Russia instigating because it was the last opportunity they had to take the Turkish Straits, the vital passage that they need to move their ships out of the Black Sea. And this would have allowed Russia to become a maritime power. And it had been for the 60 years prior to that, from the Crimean War, the absolute staple of British and French foreign policy to prevent that from happening. And all of a sudden, the British and the French decide, well, we don't really care about that anymore. You can have them. And the idea that that was duplicitous and they never really intended the Russians to get them, and there was subterfuge against the whole battles of Gallipoli, all this fascinating stuff that I think could be going on. I think you can also make a case, I don't think it's a supremely well-evidenced one, that there was British and certainly American involvement in the first Russian Revolution, the February Revolution. And certainly there are a lot of actors external to Russia that wanted revolution, from businessmen in the United States. The United States didn't have great access to Russian markets. And if you think about the effort they're putting in to control markets in Nicaragua and Honduras at that time, Russia was just an infinitely greater prize. And then you have bankers like Jacob Schiff, who are appalled at the anti-Semitism that goes on in Russia and wants to bring the Tsarist regime down for that reason. And just a general sense that the Tsar is holding Russia back. The country can't economically develop and make use of Western industry. There were rumors flying around at the time the British were involved in the revolution. And I wouldn't doubt that. I'd actually be surprised if they weren't. Certainly wouldn't try to control the direction it went when everything fell down. Sutton's case goes further, that there was an active support of the Bolsheviks. And I just found a lot of his reasoning for that when I went to the footnotes and all that to be fundamentally flawed. Like the idea of Woodrow Wilson supplying Trotsky with a passport doesn't seem to be the case. The idea of Trotsky carrying £10,000 back to fund the revolution, again, seems to be propaganda there from the Russian secret police. The British letting Trotsky go on a whim. Actually, the British were under a lot of pressure from the Russian government to let Trotsky go and detain them for as long as they could. And then the idea of the Americans supporting, or the British and the Americans supporting the Reds against the whites in Russia. See, it seems to have all fallen down to me that there was an active attempt to keep the white armies in charge there. And some of Sutton's both use of sources and things like he will often make, so for example, he makes a case that there was evidence of people in the US government talking about wanting to give Russia communism to retard the economy. And he puts a reference in for this from a kind of Senate inquiry. And the quote is truncated in a way that makes it look like that's the case. But when I went and found, like back in the 80s, you couldn't find this stuff. Right now, you can just get on the internet. So when I went and found it, it was a communist journalist the Senate had brought before them who said words to the effect of Russia will develop more slowly under a communist regime. That might be interesting to the United States. It might be a reason to leave them alone. But it wasn't because he thought communist economics would fail. It was because he thought that the people in Russia didn't want to develop at a fast rate, and the Soviets were responsive to the will of the people. So wrong on both counts. But that's the only evidence sort of could present of some dastardly plan to handicap the Russian economy through communism. So I didn't really see it. And from there, it just occurred to me that Sutton says a lot of very strange things. Like in the mid-1980s, he's convinced that the US government is secretly supporting the Sandinistas, the extremely left-leaning communist socialists in Nicaragua, against the contra-revolutionaries. This is when Ronald Reagan is pouring arms into the Contras. The whole Iran-Contra scandal is going on. And Sutton has this extreme kind of anti-communist conspiracy. And that's kind of weird, right? And then he just says bizarre things about how when the Challenger rocket ship blew up, how the statistical chances of the number of rocket ships blowing up were 250 million to one. And it's not clear how he could possibly make that calculation. And then he has speculation that the Russians used weather modification technology to move a cold front down from the northeastern United States to Florida because they had some whistleblower who, a defector, who he can't remember his name and doesn't seem to exist from my checking, who had told them that the rockets were sensitive to temperature. And all sorts of mind control, how they're never going to leave Afghanistan. That's never going to happen. It happened like 6 months after he said this, and that ultimately is going to lead up to a war between Russia and the United States in around 2010, and the Soviet Union will never fall apart. And this is really bizarre, and people kind of seem to overlook this about Sutton. And also the plucky hero in Sutton's story, two men, he talks about Stephen Byrand, who is, I hadn't heard of him, but and Richard Pearl as being the men who really know what's going on inside the US government and are really trying to stop this these technology transfers. They're the good guys. Well, when Richard Pearl is the good guy in your story, you've got to ask questions. Stephen Byrand actually sold military secrets to the Israelis. He was done for held on espionage. And Pearl similarly was involved in all sorts of dodgy dealings with China. He has a lot of loyalty to Israel and is ultimately obviously a major architect of the Iraq war. So it's just because it's really interesting that actually, and just as a side almost, the talk that is famously on YouTube is Sutton talking to a kind of like slightly far out spiritual group who are in communications of all sorts of beings of light, but also in are defending the world against these dark enemies, these Archon type entities trying to take over and install a kind of global communist regime. And I thought, well, isn't this interesting? Because their theories are propped up by Sutton's apparent research. And what that feeds into is taking this nice group of spiritual people who are talking to their spirit guides and turning them into supporters of the neoconservative agenda of missile defense shields, of very aggressive anti-communist action around the world. That's an interesting trick that's been played there. And Sutton talks about being fed information by people. So sometimes I cannot see that Sutton isn't just sort of having a laugh and making stuff as he goes, because some of the stuff he comes out with is so either poorly sourced or ridiculous. Or sometimes I wonder, well, is he being fed stuff by people who want to push a certain agenda and have pushed it through institutions like the John Birch Society? And the idea of a global communist conspiracy has been moved to justify US intervention. So I'm aware this went on, say, with the removal of Salvador Allende in Chile, the idea of connecting Allende's regime very strongly to a global communist plot that was going to do in Chile what essentially had happened in what's happening in Cambodia and what happened in Maoist China. It was just going to be the same script played out there. That was perpetrated by the CIA and put in through the John Birch Society. And in all sorts of other ways, this idea of connecting all these countries like Vietnam and Guatemala, Iran, always prior to the interventions to Moscow in some way, like they're receiving weapons, it's all part of a global thing, and playing into a conspiracy theory. That's a theme that I see repeated. I think it's a theme that's been carried out in some ways. And what's really interesting to me is ostensibly conspiracy theory is an anti-establishment thing. Even if it's wrong, it's still acting against the establishment. But turn around and look it over the way, conspiracy theory can be weaponized in support of empire. And I just wonder how that plays out in today's world in some ways with like the idea of Klaus Schwab type conspiracies around COVID. I can't really put that together in my mind, but it's just the idea that this thing that people think they are fighting the powers with could actually be subverted. That was kind of fascinating to me.
I've had that thought too as these things have played out, because I know in the popular consciousness right now, in the last week, Joe Rogan released this new comedy special on Netflix, and he says, well, we lost a lot of people during COVID and most of them are still alive. Like I think, you know, he said that, but it's still, you know, it's a couple of years too late, because we're kind of coming out of that now in the sense of like, well, most people that I know have been thinking that. I've been thinking it for a year or two at least, but he's right, of course, but COVID broke so many people's brains on all these different sides. And of course, when I, in the thick of it, when I was doing my COVID town halls, like I did 3 or 4 of these in my local area, you know, just inviting local people to come and to talk about it and encouraging them to organize on a local level to, you know, prevent mandates through the school board. But I would get some real crazies. Like I hate to be judgmental about it, but people who just like took this and ran with it. And I think it's because their worldviews had been broken open by this, and it really caused a fracturing of kind of their whole core belief system. And when that happens, and then when you have things like the Epic Times coming through and pumping all of their stuff, and then you find out the Epic Times is ran and controlled by this bizarre Chinese spiritualist group that is completely against, you know, the People's Communist Party of China. And them propagating all of these theories about the World Economic Forum and kind of the Global Health Pandemic Treaty, and stating just outright falsehoods based on the documents. I've written some articles about this, but it obscures the truth. I mean, just in what you're saying, it seems like it's a taint, kind of a taint agent to make people seem crazy, so that no one takes this issue seriously, so that the real agenda can push through underneath it.
You see, what's interesting to me about that is my background is really in spirituality groups, okay, one particular spirituality group, and a lot of looking at how people can, through, let's say, meditation techniques, have a kind of profound shift in their sense of consciousness and self, and a deeper kind of connection with the universe and other people. And what we were very aware of in that is that there's a vulnerability that creates, okay, that after someone can have an experience that turns their kind of spiritual or metaphysical view of the world upside down, they can be very vulnerable to anyone who is then there to provide them with a nice narrative. And that's really how cults start: provide the lovely experience and then offer an explanation for it that leads you into supporting the guru financially and in other ways. And so it's very cautious about how not to do that, and how to leave people in a state where they're open and free to investigate the world on that level. And what I saw was that mirrored in experiences like COVID-19 or 9/11, that when people have a big experience that shatters their view of how the temporal world works, they are very susceptible to snake oil salesman, essentially, or any kind of narrative that will make that make sense. And it's usually a totalizing, a complete narrative, like the World Economic Forum is really running it, or the shape-shifting reptilians or something. So it resets that sense of certainty, because people live with a sense of certainty, which we find very comforting, and it gets blown apart in this mysterious moment. And there's a real desire to reset it. And that there's a real opportunity there, which is probably not passed up by the powers that be. So I'm aware of this on the COVID narrative of, how it could be weaponized in terms of a kind of anti-China, Chinese kind of thing. So this is a Chinese kind of bioweapon, or it's a Chinese propaganda campaign to get all the Western countries to lock down. And, you know, I can't entirely discount that China has obviously a significant role in the disaster that happened. But how that could be weaponized in terms of the kind of right-wing anti-China sentiment that you podcast so much about. And I'm just curious about the World Economic Forum narrative, in a sense. Like, wouldn't it make sense that when you have someone like Klaus Schwab coming out and being the Bond villain, right, being this cartoonish kind of villain, I do wonder if there's an element of misdirection in that, and actually what that's not the structure that's really going on. That's the kind of like the cartoon play for people to look at. I don't know that, but I wonder how that conspiracy is weaponized to draw people's attention.
Well, I just this dovetails perfectly into, you know, the next part. I don't mean to jumble up or rush kind of the stages of this interview that we had planned, but it plays perfectly into the other book that I was reading, your book, Contemplating Conspiracy. And I was telling you before we went on that I was listening to it in the car about an hour before doing this interview, and it was kind of, it was really giving me something to think about, because you had just mentioned this idea of the sense of sureness that people like, that's comforting, the sense of certainty. And I think kind of what you posit in your book is that we should shed that sense of certainty and really consider all possible options or explanations for a certain hypothesis. And in that way, without being wedded to something that you've predetermined that is correct, then you can be open to all these different possibilities. And at the end of it, you actually end up being in a better place with a better understanding of the world. And really, that makes so much sense to me, at least as I sit here right now.
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, contemplating conspiracy is putting together those words of contemplating is a reference to contemplation or meditative practice and conspiracy. The idea kind of arose because for years I attended this particular spirituality group, right? It's infrequent seminars every couple of months or so. And I would see people come in, and oftentimes they didn't have many people to talk about this kind of stuff to in their normal world.
Right.
So they had a really enjoyable kind of Friday evening discussion. And then at some point on the Saturday, people would realize that they were sharing their space with people who had very divergent political opinions. So very similar spiritual opinions, very divergent political. And, you know, there'd be people around the table that believed 9/11 was an inside job, or there'd be people that didn't read The Guardian in the UK, or something, or there'd be people that didn't even think global warming was happening, or weren't left wing. And that was really shocking to people in a spirituality group who assumed that everyone was kind of on the green left. Okay. And to see this kind of split emerge. And then when COVID happened, I just saw that go off like a stick of dynamite. Okay. And because suddenly these people, these kind of fringe people who have been tolerated in the ashram were a danger, where they were dangerous all of a sudden, because they were telling people to not follow very sensible medical advice, like staying home and all the other things. And equally, there was a frustration building on the other side of, we can't tolerate these people anymore because they are just completely drawn into this government narrative. So the book started as a kind of an advocation sort of written to that kind of group, but more broadly applicable on, you know, would it not make more sense? This is not going to be helpful, right? Just like digging a trench and lobbing bricks at the other side. It might make you feel good, but you're only really trying to win an argument with yourself. You're trying to prove yourself right in your own mind. And that's not dialogue. You actually have to consider another person's view. And particularly talking to a kind of spirituality group, I would have thought that would have been, you know, a kind of staple of that world. I thought that they could be held to that standard, say. So that's where it came from. And then the pluralistic methodology, that's really from the philosopher Paul Feyerabend, who I was very taken by and really shifted my thinking. I think that I had this unconscious assumption that the way you learn about something is you get the right idea and you just run with it. And Feyerabend introduced this idea of making the weaker argument the stronger and advancing the motion of the whole. So the idea that knowledge is composed of two halves of something and they move together. So, for example, in this realm, you could have a view of the world that the world is very conspiratorial and Klaus Schwab runs everything, or the Illuminati do. But essentially, the direction the world goes in, it's very intentional. There's a group at the top who are setting the intentions and driving it in a certain direction. And that's certainly true in some cases. But you could also take a view that the world is kind of structural, that we set up certain structures and that necessitates certain outcomes, which is the one I'm maybe a bit more drawn to. But can we ever really know what the world is ultimately? So what you might find most beneficial is to have to build both of those arguments as strong as you can and let them interplay with each other, so you come to understand both perspectives. I must say, I find this more challenging actually around things like libertarianism and Austrian economics and, you know, sort of a priori truths or basic moral truths. Like I find it more challenging to apply there because I think I find the world to be very morally relativistic. So you know, thou shalt not kill, but it's okay to blow up Iraq and kill a million people there. So I'm more kind of wanting to find a kind of core moral position. That's something I've played more with in recent years. But certainly in terms of there is this massive attachment to the belief that we have the right ideas of the world. And that's what I think is sort of hinders us both on terms of advancing knowledge and on terms of being able to relate to our fellow human beings.
Well, I think that speaks to me right now specifically because, you know, even though I am, of course, I mean, the elephant in the room is that I'm a fellow at the Libertarian Institute. I haven't like completely discarded those core beliefs, but over time I found myself becoming less and less concerned with that starting point. And I think it's due to like a myriad of things, like people, just other libertarians and interacting in that world and getting kind of fatigued from that. But then, of course, again, a shift in my own thinking and focus to geopolitics and being anti-war and that kind of stuff. But I have found it, of course, that can be limiting. And because you're part of that insular group, there is a dogmatic kind of thought in the purity spiral that isn't unique to libertarian thought, but is like a feature of it as well. But again, it's that the kind of disenfranchisement or not caring quite as much about those dogmatic beliefs and accepting that there isn't certainty in, you know, in your beliefs or in this world, I think is liberating. I'm trying to find that quote by Paul. Is it Feyerabend? Is he German?
Feyerabend, yeah.
Feyerabend.
He's Austrian.
Oh, he's Austrian. Okay, yeah, Feyer. He says, one of them is, we need a dream world in order to discover the features of the real world we think we inhabit and which may actually be just another dream world. I like that. I'm trying to find that first one. Even our most basic assumptions, our most solid beliefs, and our most conclusive arguments can be changed, improved, or diffused, or shown to be irrelevant by a comparison with what at first looks like undiluted madness. That's nice. So
yeah. So the idea that we need contrasting theories to be able to understand if we only understand our own perspective on things, we don't even really understand our own perspective. It's only in the contrast of something else that the flaws in our position might show up.
Yeah. And that led you to, you know, throughout the chapters where you're quoting him, Paul Feyerabend, basically you discuss David Icke, you know, and this whole conspiracy culture, and that seemed kind of to be your starting point, right, when you were 18?
Yes, I had no idea there was anything wrong with the world at all until I turned 18, and it was just about when I got into the whole spirituality stuff. And I'd had a certain disenfranchisement, right, coming out of high school and going into high school thinking, oh, this is going to be great, it's all going to be about education and learning, you know, and being positive about it, and then really being brought down by the, you're just here to pass an exam, mate, you know, that's it, you know, kind of thing, that we don't really care about these subjects at all. And what on earth has this all been about? And it was at the time that George W. Bush was elected president of the United States, and it was kind of apparent to me that he wasn't the best or the brightest the US had to offer, but also just so weird that they would select the son of a man who did it the one before. You know, just like, what are the chances of that? Like, there's 300 million people. What? How can that right. possibly be?
Yeah.
You know, there's something not quite right here. The world is not working the way. And then, yeah, I just saw David Icke's book, The Biggest Secret, and he talked about the world being, you know, it appears to be run this way, but really, it's, I think it was called the Babylonian Brotherhood at the time. They're all pulling the strings. And having just done a sort of history course at school, I thought, well, I did sit there for the history course. Like, is any of this true? Who knows? This wasn't just made up. How do we know that? I don't know. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be intriguing if someone could write an alternative view of history that would actually hold up? Or would it just crumble to sand as soon as you looked at it, right? So that was kind of my intrigue of David Icke. And he said a lot of crazy things, like the world is run by shape-shifting reptilians and the CIA trafficked drugs. Right. And it didn't strike me as particularly crazier to think the CIA trafficked drugs and the world is run by shape-shifting reptilians. They both seemed, you know, absolutely wackadoodle to me, because the CIA is the group that you see on TV shows stopping terrorists or something. They don't traffic. So it was, you know, looking into that stuff and finding out so much of it, and so much of it was, you know, true, essentially, on Icke at the time. He'd been talking about the incursion into Panama and the Iraq War and so on. And then he said this thing about, George Bush has come to power in the US. Now, you're going to see some fabled enemy brought forth, probably from the Middle East, to justify divine intervention. There'll be some terrorist act, and then there'll be a war in the Middle East because that's what they want to control. And, you know, I think he'd read Brzezinski or something. And then, of course, that all happened. Like, whoa, that's some predictive power there. So that was really intriguing for me, and I kind of left it alone for a while, and years later went back to look at what was that about, because it was like taking a sledgehammer to my brain and just cracking open my conventional view of the world and allowing madness to run in and really taking a red pill and stepping into a kind of wonderland, and then not ultimately remaining in that wonderland, but having to kind of mix the red and the blue, if you like, and come to some kind of like center position between the two.
I think one thing is, as I've gotten older, and I'm lucky enough to, most of my 20s have been captured in this podcast where, you know, I'll intermittently, you know, so you can trace the lineage of, you know, my kind of evolution in this space. But one thing, being a lawyer and being a legal professional, I think through my experience, I've kind of gotten more and more comfortable being in this gray area and living with uncertainty, because the law is nothing but uncertainty. There's all these gray areas. And I was dealing with an issue, you know, earlier this week about custody decisions and whether the court has the power to make a decision for parents, or whether the court has to pick one of the parents and give them the power to make the decision. And then it's like, okay, well, if the court is doing that, what if the court picks one parent to give them the decision-making power, but it's clear that the court made that decision based off of making the decision? If that makes sense, it's like, where does this child gonna go to school? Mom says one school A and dad says school B. Well, what if the court understands that it can choose mom and mom will choose school A, but what if the court gives the power to mom because it thinks that school A is the better school, not because it thinks that mom is the better person to make that decision? So isn't that still the court effectively making that choice? And the statute says the court is supposed to pick the parent and give them the authority to make that decision. Sure. But are we going to delve into the underlying reasons the court made that decision? That's a gray area. And it's like, you need to live in that space when you're a practitioner of the law. And even in all these different things, it's like, okay, well, if someone is convicted of a crime, that means the jury thinks that, you know, the prosecution has proven the case beyond a reasonable doubt. But even beyond a reasonable doubt leaves room for doubt. What if there's an unreasonable doubt? Or, you know, it's by nature, it's not certainty. And then you're dealing with other standards of proof that are like, well, a preponderance of the evidence. Well, that means we've proven this to a 51% certainty. Or probable cause means we've proven this to a 35% certainty. Or reason to believe means that we've proven this to a 10% certainty. And that leaves, you know, a 90% gray area. And not being so certain of your presuppositions or you've decided that this theory is true and we're just going to stick to that, because certainty and cohesion and feeling like you have this false sense that you understand the world around you feels comfortable. But maybe getting comfortable in that in-between space where everything is mystical is really the path forward and leads to more wisdom. I think that's true.
Yeah, it's really interesting for me to, I'll just get as an example from the series on the First World War. So many of the historians who are professors at prestigious universities do such excellent work, right? And you've got people on the fringes who are attempting to critique or find a different angle on that. And okay, where could that creep in? Because if you have a group of people who are so knowledgeable, and it's interesting, it's like in the foundations, right? So there's core assumptions that are made. So the idea that, say, members of the British government, Edward Grey and so on, the foreign minister, were actively trying to avoid war, were actively trying to avoid this European conflict. That's a foundational assumption that no one really questions, because that's what he said he was doing, and that's what he essentially set out to do, and it was always recorded that he did. But if you take that assumption out and look at the results of what he did, well, everyone describes him as bumbling and having, you know, making these decisions which are inexplicable all the time. Well, but if you're prepared to step outside the convention and say, well, what if he actually wanted to do this? And everything becomes explicable. But it takes quite a radical mind to do that. That's not a mind that I didn't find anyone inside the academy who could kind of go there. So it's interesting, you know, that's a core interest of mine, of where these unconscious assumptions are made that then contain knowledge and hold it in a certain way that we cannot step outside of. And it takes someone from outside that field then to interject and point out the obvious that isn't obvious.
Well, then talk a little bit about this thought experiment with David Icke and the, if he had written one sentence at the beginning of his book, because I think that plays in right here. Where can, in like, where can we find utility in David Icke, and where does he, you know, really provide a role that I think is important, even if we don't, you know, take the whole red bottle of red pills?
Yeah, so a lot of utility, I think. So this kind of comes from, again, being in spirituality and the concept of an initiatory myth, okay? And this is the idea that the kind of spiritual myths from around the world aren't ultimately meant to be taken literally, okay? But when you get into them, when you go from being a no good drunkard and a villain to trying to tidy your life up in some way and get some kind of higher meaning, it's literally is a myth in some way, a story that has allegorical value. And as you progress on with it, the more mythic literal elements fall away as the spiritual elements become more real. So this is a view of did Jesus allow the blind to see? Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But at some point, you might see that it's actually the greater value to me is that a kind of spiritual sight has opened up, and I can see the world in a way where I connect with my fellow humans and value each life equally, and try and bring love and happiness to the world. So something like that, you know. So there's a moving from a very literal, or more symbolic understanding off that. And I saw this the same way. Well, I can't. Is this pattern not playing out in conspiracy where, if I ask people how they got into the sensible geopolitical research they were doing, they would often have the same reaction. Well, when I'd ask that question of spirituality people who are into something a bit kind of like Zen Buddhism or something that, or Advaita Vedanta, something that's considered a bit difficult and erudite and all the rest, and they would often like look a bit embarrassed and, you know, have some story about crystals and spirit guides or something. And in the same way with people into geopolitical research, you'd ask that question and they'd often have some like wild conspiracy story that hooked them in initially. And I thought, oh, okay, so both areas have initiation myths that hook people in because the substance is too refined. It's what you ultimately arrive at is too refined to see at the beginning. So you need a story with flashing lights to break you out of your conventionality. And that's what I saw David Icke is doing. He's written a kind of initiatory myth, if you like, about the world being run by reptilians, irrespective of whether it is or it isn't. It has that value because the work of the people I went on to, like I went on to read a lot of John Pilger and Peter Dale Scott, listen to Scott Horton's podcast, you know, but I don't think I could have gone straight to that when I was 18 years old. I think it's too detailed, too nuanced, and in some ways it's too difficult, right? It's what I needed was a kind of a grand story narrative about this secret society that existed since ancient Egypt and before, and other was off-worldly in some sense, and that breaks open reality. So that's the kind of mythic view of it. And my interest regarding your question, if David Icke could have put at the start of his book just a single sentence saying this is entirely a work of fiction, and then our whole view of him might change into some genius writer who has written a kind of an account of the world that completely differs from our own but explains it on a satirical level, if you like. But his book has a potency and a power because he didn't do that, because it's kind of scary because people read it and think, well, maybe there are reptilians. We might not admit that, but at 4 a.m you're thinking, like, actually, you know, I saw the Queen Mother the other week and she did look a bit, you know, funny, right? You know,
right.
So, or are these like these archontic entities existing in other worlds, or are the power elite out to get us? And it has a kind of potency as opposed to something like Star Wars, which, you know, is really the great myth of our age in a sense. But I'm sure there are some people out there who think it really happened. But in general, people take it as a fiction, and it's far more widespread and accepted and has a different kind of power. But it in some ways doesn't have, like, I would say people have probably been more powerfully transformed by reading David Icke's books than reading Star Wars in many ways, or watching Star Wars. Star Wars has a subtler and broader effect, and they're more powerfully transformed because David Icke plays with that idea that this is real, quote unquote. And in a sense it is, because in a sense the kind of archetypal principles it contains of the nature of evil and the nature of control and the human capacity to give their power away and to give away decision making to people they perceive to be bigger boys higher up the chain, that's all real. The way I might have expressed it, you could certainly question, but there is certainly a very much a reality in his work on that level.
And it also has utility in the sense that you quoted Tom Woods in your book too, because Tom used the David Icke thing to say, well, you know, some days I am thinking about it and I think, well, these people must be reptilians because they're so evil, right?
Yeah, so isn't that interesting? So David Icke creates it as a literal idea and Tom Woods adopts it as a mythical idea. Okay, so people will not, if you're on Tom Woods' mailing list, you will not infrequently get one of the headline, you'll never guess what the lizard people have done now, right?
Right.
Doesn't it work perfectly? Aren't these people lizards? And in a sense, like, how else? There's something in that, right? And we've got to value that kind of use of myth and metaphor to convey, because what other title would Tom put there? Oh, you'll never guess what the people with psychopathic tendencies have done now. It doesn't convey a lizard. You got it instantly, right? You're saying, look, and you're really, because we have this tendency to project onto other people that they're like me in some way. And people do this massively with politicians, that they think they, when they talk about family values and all the rest and making America great again or whatever it is, they go, well, I have family values and I'd like to make America great again and I'd like to live in a more peaceful, harmonious world where everyone is more prosperous. So the fact that they're saying that, I could very easily accept they do too. And the best way to break out of that is to say, look, they're a lizard, right? Take off their skin. It's a lizard beneath there. They're just saying that to convince you. And on a mythic level, that works far more powerfully than a more rational explanation. And that's why I talk in that chapter about, well, David, like, let's say he's not right, but he's in a sense more right than a lot of other people are. So I just play a clip in the podcast and a quote in the book of Arnold Schwarzenegger leading this chant for George W. Bush and his re-election campaign, and the George W. Bush is looking after your family and this kind of nonsense, right? Just how he's making the economy boom and people chanting George W. Bush, George W. Bush. So let's say that George Bush isn't a shape-shifting reptile. Well, those people are correct about his physical form, that he doesn't actually, on a physical level, his cells don't change into those of a reptile. On the inner form, they're completely wrong. And David Icke is completely right, if you look at who he is as a person. So, you know, and I don't see why David Icke should be considered more wrong just because he's wrong on a physical level. I actually think it's kind of a balance. It's kind of a wash at best, you know. Well, but for really, on the valuable decision of are you going to elect him or not, actually, you should listen to David Icke. You know, he's not the people chanting his name. He's got a better idea of who this guy is, even if it's, you know, we disagree on the metaphysics of it.
And it's kind of, there's this duality too, where, you know, David Icke might be completely, you know, one direction on the red pill side of things. And then the traditional side, you know, mainstream is just as wrong, except on the other side.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so it rises a balance point. It's like, I think it's like psychological that when, you know, when something goes extremely out of balance in your mind, if you become extremely depressed, you can also become manic to, as a kind of balancing factor. And I think human societies collectively have that. And this is really what the point I was making to, you know, people interested in spirituality or psychotherapy or something, that if you don't like the crazy conspiracy theorist who's ranting about stuff that we could all agree is really far out, the solution to that is not to tell them to shut up any more than it is to tell part of your mind to shut up when they go out of balance. The solution is a kind of integration. You've got to, well, why is that arising? And what is the crazy conspiracy guy telling us about the nature of society that is too sucked into a dream in some sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And you extend that to Philip K. Dick too, which I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that, because I really do enjoy Philip K. Dick, even if I haven't read him in a long time. But The Man in the High Castle, in his piece where he was saying essentially that, I don't know, he had some kind of a medication for a tooth operation, and he came home and had some kind of a fever dream where he hallucinated that this was the actual world, you know, this alternative history that he was claiming he had remembered as if he lived it, where the Nazis won and they took over the United States. But then you were also saying, and I'll let you explain it, but you were also saying that that is the reality. You know, that might sound like crazy, but maybe it's an allegory for the reality of the United States emerging from the World War II as a police state, you know, in the same legs as Nazi Germany.
Yeah. So, I mean, Philip K. Dick's an interesting one. Obviously, a man of a very powerful imaginative mind, and was troubled by the belief that his novels might actually be real in some sense. That, so the Man in the High Castle, where the Nazis and the Japanese take over and occupy the United States after the Second World War, and Dick confessed at some point after the publication of the novel that he believed this was real and an alternative timeline, and he'd been there, and there was these merging between timelines that he was able to experience. Also very interesting, he said that he deliberately did not say that to after the publication of the novel, because it would change the way people would perceive it. And that's the interesting point I'm making about Ike, that whether we say something just in one sentence is mythical or literal changes the whole reception of the work in some way. So Dick might have been castigated as a lunatic if he'd said that. The book might have had a narrower but in some sense deeper following of people who really believed it happened. And yeah, that was just the take I took on it, that in a sense you could say it was real because of things like Operation Paperclip, the bringing over of the Nazi scientists, the idea of now we're in this existential battle with Russia, we need to win by any means necessary, and all those things about liberty, they need to be put on hold whilst we experiment with radiation on human beings and do the MKUltra program and start going around the world smashing up societies. You could definitely say that America kind of became infected to a much greater degree of a Nazi ideology. So allegorically, Dick might be picking up on something that's kind of real, a real trend there.
Hang on, I'm just going to stop sharing my screen, so maybe because we're having some connection problems, but I'm just going to stop sharing. So I'm not disappearing. I can still see you, but I just want to see if that works better. So so then turning back, though, to your COVID book, is your COVID-19 book, does it kind of go off these same ideas that we've been discussing, or does it take a different kind of thesis altogether?
To a degree, I wrote it for a group here for submission to an independent inquiry the country I live in, the Isle of Man, had around COVID, an independent inquiry, but ordered by the government. So how independent? And we felt that, well, it probably won't get a read, but to say nothing at this point is to wave the big white flag. So I wrote it as a submission to that, questioning the nature of the state's response to COVID. And it wasn't quite as philosophical or mythical as that. It incorporated principles. So really, it was a chance also for me to just a kind of catharsis of getting my rage out there that had been pent up for like 3 years at that point. And the book is called Measuring the Mandates, because questioning the state's response to COVID-19. And I incorporate, it's really, without ever mentioning the word anarchism, it's really an anarchist evaluation of the state's response to COVID. And I attempted to be philosophical around it in setting the premise as, okay, the state came out in 2020 and told us two things. It told us that there was a deadly virus on its way from China, and that it and only it could protect us from said virus. And we needed to shut up, quite literally, not complain on the internet, and do as we were told. And anyone who didn't do that was endangering everyone. So 3 years later on, can those claims be justified? And I'll just describe the first chapter, but the idea of like measuring the mandate is like, can they be justified? And how would you know? Because society does not stand still to evaluate the impact of a virus, and it doesn't stand still to evaluate the impacts of your interventions against the virus. Everything is moving the whole time, and people want to conveniently ignore this and pull the statistics out that make their case. So my sort of central case, I went through analyzing the masks and the lockdowns and the things that shall not be mentioned in different chapters, but I started on the concept of iatrogenic deaths. And that just means doctor-induced death. So we're really talking about democide here, about killing by the state. And as one part of that, I picked up on a report, which I think was massively overlooked by Amnesty International, called As If Disposable. And it was about the treatment of elderly people in the UK when the pandemic was announced. So immediately, 25,000 of them were evicted from their hospital beds and sent to care homes here, there, and everywhere, not necessarily where they come from, which is, of course, stressful. Then staffing levels were reduced at care homes because if you had a brother's cousin's uncle who had been to a barbecue with someone who tested positive, you couldn't go into work anymore. All those kind of support staff, like people who do hair and nails and other things, weren't coming in. Family members weren't coming in. Inspectors didn't go in. Doctors weren't going in, but rather were following protocols to, because people had COVID, this new Chinese virus. They stood no chance of surviving it. So you might as well just move them on to the end of life pathways quickly. And what you see then is a massive spike in the use of drugs like midazolam, going along with government instructions from the NHS to give out really deadly doses of this drug, the drug that suppresses respiratory function, so you can't clear your lungs if you have a cold. And lo and behold, what you see there is a giant spike in the death rate, which is exactly what you'd expect to see. Forget about any virus if the government carried out the protocols it did carry out. And then the same in December, because it's a virus and everything is interpreted that way now, we don't need to be handing out antibiotics. So the rate of prescriptions of antibiotics crashes through the floor. And lo and behold, you get what you'd expect to see if the rate of prescriptions of antibiotics fell through the floor. You get a corresponding big jump in the death rate. So my point was really not to make grandiose claims about whether the COVID virus exists or viruses exist in general or what was going on, but to say, well, that's not really a question for me to answer. That's a case for the state to make. The state has said there is this deadly virus on the way. And one of the things it's pointed to make that case is the increase in death rate, first in Italy and then elsewhere. But hang on a minute, that increase in death rate only happened after the protocols changed. And it's very clear that the protocols killed massive amounts of people. There was a massive democide in the year 2020. So to even make the case for the virus increasing the death rate, you would first have to subtract the state killing. And nobody's made any effort to do that. So nobody from the state anyway. So where is this case? And that's kind of the way it proceeds. And I talk about at the end the song 99 Red Balloons, how the world destroys itself through the countries going to war because red balloons fly through the sky. And was COVID such a red balloon that it either was much more minimal than people thought or wasn't a thing at all? And the interventions were the things that did the vast majority of the killing. And then I link it into Maoism. So it's really a kind of where interventions... The worst thing in the world are interventions to improve humanity. They're not destructive acts. Evil is never as bad as good when good is unconstrained in what it feels it can do. So the worst things that happened in the 20th century were like the Maoist Great Leap Forward of actually an attempt to improve agriculture was the thing that led to the 30 million deaths. And now the effort to fight a virus is the thing that led to all the people dying in 2020. It's these state-run programs. So it was really an anarchist take on COVID-19.
And what was that drug that you had said that was being prescribed? Because I remember, you know, kind of early on, I linked up with this attorney a couple counties over from me who was going through this specifically, and she was taking some cases, fighting for people who were currently in the hospital on respirators, fighting for their right to force the hospital to give them alternative medicines or to allow another physician to come in, because you had the situation where people were getting sick, they were being put in hospital, and they were their overall condition was deteriorating to the point where they couldn't be moved. So now they're stuck in the hospital, they can't be moved without killing them, but the hospital refuses to allow a third-party physician to come in and administer drugs that they think are below the standard of care. And
so that's a different case. The response to COVID from those opposed to it went down two different lines. So one line was that drugs like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin were not being prescribed and they should have been. Fine. That's just not the case I made, because I didn't want to make the case that instead of doing this, the state should have done this. Now, you could say the state should have taken its hands off and let doctors prescribe drugs. You could make the drugs they feel are best. You could make an anarchist argument that way. My case was different to that. My case was that the state is prescribing drugs, and the drug I was talking about was midazolam. It might have a slightly different name in the United States, but this is essentially a respiratory depressant that could be used if you want to put someone on a ventilator, or it's used in end-of-life care. It's used in
palliative care.
Along with morphine as a way, palliative care. So the NHS issued guidelines in the early part of like the March time of the 2020, instructing doctors to hand out doses of midazolam that were clearly lethal and instructing them to ignore the difficulties that might arise from that with respiration. And it's just very, very obvious that that would have killed people. And there are anecdotal accounts of people contacting journalists about this. Is a journalist, Jackie DeVoy, who made a documentary film of people talking about their loved ones going into hospital in perfectly reasonable condition and then essentially being put on the doses of these drugs and then not realizing what was going on until it was too late. There were doctors that came out against it, writing letters to the NHS. And it's just very clear from the graph that there's a massive spike in the use of this drug, and it just overlaps perfectly with the spike in the death rate. So what that answered for me was kind of the mystery of how the geographic and temporal mystery of COVID, that COVID is a virus that apparently it's around doing something somewhere from September 2019 or whatever, apparently, but it doesn't do any big scale killing until Tedros of the World Health Organization comes out and instructs the world to say, well, it's now a pandemic, ready your hospitals. And as soon as he says that, the killing just goes through the roof. The dying off goes through the roof. But with massive disparities, like Italy has a massive death rate, but only in the north of the country. And neighboring Slovenia hardly has anything. Spain goes up to 140% at a time where Portugal, I think, was a maximum of 20%. It's in the US, it's really divided by state. In New York City, it's divided by the particular regions. So the timing and the geographic distribution, some doctors said early on, it's not compatible with the virus, because the virus won't respect international boundaries this way. And it won't just fire up right in the moment when the NHS announces it. It's not waiting for Tedros to introduce it to the world before it starts killing. It looks like it's caused by some sort of hospital protocol. And I initially thought it was hydroxychloroquine trials, where they were giving toxic doses, and then I found the numbers of that far too small. So that's what I think happened. It was the mass distribution of end-of-life drugs, essentially, palliative care drugs.
Well, the reason why I mentioned that attorney, and I failed to get to the point soon enough, but the reason I brought her up is because she was working on a case like that, where she wanted a third-party doctor to come in and administer this drug. But what she was really telling me, and this is relatively early on, was that they were putting people on ventilators, and they were giving essentially what you're saying is that they were giving them this end of life care drugs. And I don't know if it was remdesivir is what she was talking about. I just can't remember what the drug was that she was saying was killing people. But that was her big, she was telling me about, trying to uncover this, because the same thing was happening in the United States. So yeah, that is, of course, what the protocol was that came through. I remember all this talk, anecdotally, about, oh, we need more ventilators, and we got to put people on ventilators, and ventilators, and then, yeah, this drug.
Yeah, it could have been remdesivir. Remdesivir is an antiviral that was brought in to fight COVID. I spent quite a bit of time looking particularly at Robert Kennedy's claims around remdesivir, and I actually thought the dangers of it, just based on Kennedy's work, were exaggerated. So I didn't include that in the report. Okay. But it was not. Now, if I looked somewhere else, maybe I would have agreed. But just looking at Kennedy's book, The Real Anthony Fauci, I didn't find it as compelling in that area. Other things Kennedy said, I think, were spot on, but not on remdesivir.
Yeah, and it might have been a different drug too, because it's like, all these pharmaceutical names were floating around at the time. Mm. And it's been a while since I've looked into it or was, have done any work too concerned with the COVID stuff. But it might've been a different kind of drug. So, So where can people find, I'm going to put links in the show notes page, but where can people find your books at and purchase them?
They're all at deepstateconsciousness.com. They're either available for download from the website, or there's links through to Amazon. If you type in measuring the mandate or contemplating conspiracy on Amazon, that will come up there. The podcast is, again, on deepstateconsciousness.com, the Deep State Consciousness podcast, available on podcatchers. If you scroll back through or scroll through the YouTube channel, you will find the episode on Anthony Sutton and the Russian Revolution. There's an episode on Sutton himself, and there's a couple of episodes on Russia's involvement in the First World War and the Russian Revolution, where I talk through exactly where I think the flaws are in his work. And if you download a PDF of Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, I think you'll be able to check whether I'm right or not. Okay, but I think you'll see what I'm talking about there.
And some of it, just briefly before we go, some of it was especially with the Challenger, man. So my dad, when I was a young kid, I remember he had this really thick book called The Challenger Launch Decision. And I don't know if you're familiar with that book or if you've read it. It's a tome, But he actually read it, and he explained to me that, you know, all of these things were being rushed, and they were, like, I think recycling as many things that they could use that NASA was. And one of them was is that there was a company, someone was ringing the alarm bells about the O-ring sealants on some of these pieces, and that they were going bad and needed to be replaced, that there was a long track record of this being an issue that was actively ignored by NASA because they wanted to push these routine launches. And, you know, people were saying the O-rings are bad, they need replacing, whatever, whatever. And then finally culminated in the Challenger explosion. And for Sutton to, I don't know, he just kind of shoots from the hip and says, well, the odds of that failure happening are like 10 million to one or like 20,000 to one or something like that. He's like, and then he says, well, the Russians could have just shot it with the 308 round. And I'm just like, I don't know, like, what, where are you getting this from?
Yeah, and they have fishing boats and they sail off, and then somebody had it, the KGB had a party that night. Like, how does Anthony Sutton know when the KGB have parties?
Right.
Is anyone hearing this? Is anyone hearing what this guy is saying and thinking, hang on, he's out to lunch? Why is he such a staple of, like, it's just uncritically accepted that Wall Street funded the Bolsheviks? Because this guy, who clearly talks a lot of nonsense, said so. That's
yeah.
Why. And look, I'm one of those people. I kind of like, oh, yeah, Anthony Sutton, very sensible guy for years. And then it's just, same. When I saw the core of his case was wrong, it's like, oh, yeah, actually, he's just talking complete nonsense. Why haven't I noticed this?
yeah. Well, okay. Well, I really enjoyed this, Richard. I'm glad. I shouldn't let such a lapse happen before I have you on again to talk about something. But just in closing, I know you mentioned where people can go get your work, but what projects do you have that you just want to kind of tease before we go?
Project. Well, one in particular. I did a podcast series on Zionism, and like all these things, I thought I'll do 6 episodes, cover the whole history. And I got 10 episodes through, and I was in the 1920s. So
yeah,
I'm currently turning that into a book. Okay. And I'm pretty much there. I think by the end of the month, it might even be ready to go. And that's called Zionology, which is, it's Zion ontology, as in looking at the foundation of the thing, but it's also a play on Scientology. So what I'm suggesting is that the reason people at large kind of struggle to understand what's going on with the state of Israel is because they're seeing it as kind of a nation state that wants to find, I don't know, some sort of two-state solution or something. And really what you have to do is look at it as being a cult that with strange belief systems that took over a nation state and ultimately got nuclear weapons. And when you see it as being a cult, you can then understand what's going on in Gaza today. So I trace the history and evolution of that idea and how it's interacted with the sort of, it starts off as this idea that's going to be a shining, as Theodore Herzl talks about Israel, it's going to be a shining example to the world of how to treat the native population. I'm not kidding, he wrote this. And but we might need to just hurry a few of them off the land. And 120 years later, we have the carpet bombing of Gaza is the result of that kind of attitude. So it's a look at the concept of an ends justifies the means philosophy, and when you start out something by saying I'll just make a little moral sacrifice now and it'll be good, the moral sacrifices just get bigger and bigger with time. So that's what I'm, the podcast series is out, people can listen to it, and it will be available as a fully footnoted book by hopefully the end of this month.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. It's just like you go from what you were talking about with Theodore Herzl at the beginning, and then now it's like there's IDF soldiers actively right now justifying the use of rape as a method of detaining Palestinian inmates. So at first, you know,
shining example to the world. Yes.
When these stories were first coming out, of course, you know, with my work on the Uyghur stuff, I tried to treat apples to apples and really scrutinize things and hold things to the same level of account. So I was looking at where these reports were coming from, and it was like, well, a detainee met with his attorney, and then his attorney came out and said the detainee says that other people are saying that they've witnessed rape, which is hearsay. There might be an exception to that. And I'm like, okay. But then the stories kept coming and they kept coming, and then whistleblowers started coming out from the IDF, and now you have the accused actively admitting on, you know, Israeli television that they're raping detainees. And then now you have politicians saying, well, actually, this is a good thing that we need to do, and we should be allowed to do this. So it's just wild.
Yeah, it's just, it's so comparable to a cult to me that it starts out for the betterment of its members, and then quickly it becomes the members are there for the betterment of the cult, and the members are ultimately like completely sacrificable, as is every moral principle going, and the only thing that matters is the sustaining of the cult. The cult yeah. becomes like a golem creature in and of itself that just needs to feed and feed and feed. So that what I do in the book actually is I go from the sort of positive beginnings and the intentions through to the first outbreak of violence and sort of Arab initiated violence against the immigration centers and the Jewish retaliations of that, to the point where Zionists assassinate the first Jew, a guy called Jacob Dahan, because I think it's interesting to end at that point where this is something that's set up ostensibly to save the Jewish people, and then it becomes permissible to kill one Jew in support of it, just one, okay, to get things going, and to ensure the project can be there for the greater good of Jews, and how that then transforms into a justification of just greater and greater and greater levels of violence.
Well, you know, the on the flip side too of that is the United States and the Manhattan Project, and that's why I was so like keen to tell this story about the plutonium injections, where it's like we have to nuke Japan because we need to save American lives. And that's the only way to do it. So therefore, not to mention the sunk cost, that we're not doing it because of the sunk cost. We're not doing it to project force throughout the post-war years. We're doing it to save American lives. And that's the main, the theory behind Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But then it's like, oh, well, to come and find out that the scientists behind the whole thing were irradiating Americans without their knowledge, injecting them with plutonium and uranium and other types of radioisotopes really destroys that. Or we did the Trinity explosion and we forgot some of the families that were in the blast area and that were hit with fallout. Or our scientists, while they were working at Los Alamos, they were getting radioisotopes all over their clothes, and they would do the laundry. Their wives would do the laundry, and all that radioactivity would go into the groundwater. Or the Trinity test irradiating all these states, and then infant mortality going up. Anyways, like I could wax poetically on that for a while, but yeah, all these things. It's a similar death cult,
Yeah, a death cult. Yeah.
So. All right, Richard. Well, thanks. Always a pleasure to have you on. And once you release your book, we'll have to have you back on to talk about Zionism in more detail.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you.
Hey, you all. It's fundraising time again at the Libertarian Institute. We try not to do this to you too often, but business is business after all. I got a great group of guys and a gal at the Institute, and I got to pay them. So just go to libertarianinstitute.org/donate to pick your price and help out. Got some great kickbacks too, books and shirts. Great ones. That's libertarianinstitute.org/donate. And thank you all very much.